Hi, welcome to the Night Cafe. My guest today is stand-up comic Devin Keith. You can introduce yourself.
Thanks for having me, Anthony. It's a pleasure to be here.
Of course. So I'm happy to have you. So Devin is prepared a list of five things, as you guys know by this point. This is a show where I find out about what people think, like, shaped them, influenced them, what were, like, the big things. It could be anything. I find out as we go. Devin's prepared a list. It's always best to just, like, hop right in. So, like, what's the first thing?
Okay. Let's get right down to it. I love the idea of this show, by the way. I think, this is the first podcast that I've been on.
Welcome.
So thanks for having me, because I think this all transpired when I just approached you and told you how much I was enjoying
your podcast. You said you listened, and I was like, now you're coming on. Anyone that listens gets to come on.
You know, it's a great idea, because you get to listen to people's arguments.
Mm-hmm.
Really, that's what I mean. You get to hear people make the case for things and whatever they were, whatever those influences were on these people's lives. Like your episode with the Steve Malloy encouraged me to listen to the Earl Sweatshirt record after that, you know. And with Trevor Selby, I revisited the Oasis catalog.
That was an interesting one, because Oasis, I knew so little about, and he knows.
Oh my God!
To know about Oasis.
You know, I had seen Oasis in concert in Detroit when I was in high school, and it's still one of the. It was a rock show. They were so cool. They were British rock stars. And Noel went missing before the show, and no one really said anything, and they just hoped that he would show up, and he did, like, 5 minutes before they were supposed to be on.
So cool.
Yeah, you know, while Ben Harper was still on. It was a pretty good lineup. It was like a Christmas show for the local radio station, so.
That's awesome.
It was like Bush and Ben Harper, and so if I may date myself, yeah. I think it was 1999, I think. But anyway, speaking of dating myself, I suppose we should begin. I am going to go in chronological order.
Oh, absolutely.
I think it would only make sense as far as what is... I don't want to say that anything is the least important, but I think they will progressively become more important. So,
sure enough.
Anyway, and maybe we'll spend a little time on the last one, but we'll begin with 1984, the Teenaged Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Okay.
And by the way, I think they're just teenage, aren't they? They're not teenaged. Yeah.
I honestly don't know.
I'm trying to be grammatically correct, but I think they're just...
I think if MLA, it would be teenage, yes. But I think
technically they're just teenage.
Yeah, they're teenage.
With no D.
So is this the cartoon? Is this the first movie? Is this...
Everything.
Uh-huh.
And by the way, the first movie was great. What do you know about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles?
I don't know that much about it. My first exposure to them was that arcade game where you had the jump in the
game. No kidding.
And you could go back and
Yeah.
So that was how I knew them. I didn't know the shows or the movies, but there was an arcade that I would go to that had
with
that.
With the just terrible graphics, not in the game itself, but... on the side, you know, the art.
In
April, like, who is this poor B actress who like, that was her only... she wasn't the April from the movies.
No.
She was just, God. And I think it was frustrating to those of us who were pretty devout
so,
Ninja Turtles.
1984, cartoon is in full swing.
Well, 84, if I'm correct, was when they... were first sketched up, and was it? It's Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird.
Uh-huh.
You know, according to the legend, I mean, it was just a joke. These guys had just whipped up this character, these Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, you know, named after these great artists and Renaissance men, as a joke. But it became this comic. I was born in 1983, but I think I embrace every last second of the 80s that I can. But the cartoon, I want to say, came out sometime around maybe when I was in kindergarten, the original cartoon on TV. I think it was like an after-school cartoon.
Uh-huh.
And that would have been late 80s. But I remember my brother Drew collected comics. And he was a really, I mean, he collected comics, and he went to expos and conventions. But I remember just those long boxes upon boxes of mint condition. I mean, early Spider-Man and Superman comics, even. And of course, we had the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles comics. And I remember, he would take me to these comic book shops. My older brothers are much older than mm-hmm. I am. So when I was a kid, they were all in high school when I was in kindergarten, first grade.
Uh-huh.
And so I remember my brother Drew taking me to the comic book shops, our local comic book shops. And I remember picking up issue number 3, and it wasn't a reissue. It was just because it was still there.
Yeah.
And I think that was the first comic book that I read cover to cover, just in one sitting, just in my bed.
Mm-hmm.
And I must have been 6, maybe 7 years old.
Do you remember what they had to do in it?
I think it was the first issue in which we were introduced to Crane. He was that brain sort of guy. And he lived in the waste of this robot, this cross between like a Cyclops, RoboCop sort of character, and what's his name from who lived in the basement in the Goonies.
Oh,
he looked kind of like that guy.
Okay.
But Crane, so I think Crane was the second villain to come along after, of course, the Shredder.
Yeah.
But I guess we should get to what it was about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, because cartoons had always been important, and comics had always had an impact on my life,
mm-hmm.
Whether they were the Sunday comics or comic books, and I, in fact, for a while, I had been planning on going to college to study illustration.
Yeah,
and I was an art student in high school. And of course, like I mentioned, the Turtles had a big influence on me. But I guess the moment that sort of set everything off was when I guess I was in first grade, maybe, and I was watching one of those episodes of the cartoon after school. And in this particular episode, the turtles had been tied up, or they had been captured, or something. I think by Crane, maybe. And there was a bomb. Such a far-fetched scenario, right? And there was a clock on the bomb, and Leonardo or Donatello had pointed out that the bomb would set off in 10 or 15 minutes or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And Raphael said, "Does that include commercial breaks?" And I lost my shit. I had never heard anything like that in my life. I got on the phone. I was calling my friends. "Did you just hear that? Was that real? Did that actually happen?" Like, he broke the fourth wall.
I love it. That's
yeah.
Awesome.
This was a kid's cartoon series. And he had broken a major rule, first of all. And to me, it felt like every rule had ever been broken. And when you're a kid, especially of that age, your life is so oversaturated with rules. There's a rule to everything. And rules really just dictate your life when you're a kid. And to have witnessed that, I felt like we were all getting away with something.
Oh, I love that. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. That's such a fun, moment.
It changed everything for me. Because that's when you realize, okay, life doesn't have to be so serious.
Yeah.
Because, again, when you're a kid, you think, okay, you're a kid, and maybe it's okay to play outside and to watch cartoons, but then you grow up and everything's going to be serious, mm-hmm. and everything's going to be taxes and bills and deadlines. So to have seen that on television, on network television at 4 o'clock in the afternoon,
yeah,
and it just made no sense whatsoever, and it was glorious.
Yeah,
it was
so cool.
Yeah, yeah, and because in the cartoon, Raphael was kind of the smartass. He was kind of
the
comic relief. Yeah, yeah, and you know, Michelangelo had always sort of had that role, but he also was the dude, pizza, you know what I mean?
Yeah, the pizza, that's another big way I know them, because yeah. I think I was that age in between the two turtle resurgences. Like, there was one before I was a kid and one after.
Mm-hmm.
So I know them as, like, they were Domino's spokesmen at some point, too.
Were they Domino's? For the
Pizza Hut? They used to be in pizza commercials.
I think it's... you're right. It's Pizza Hut.
It was Pizza Hut.
It was Pizza Hut, yeah.
They were, oh, right, because the Noid was Domino's.
The Noid was Domino's. But you know what, though? In the first movie, which I think was a 1989 release, there was some product placement. And one of the opening scenes, I'm trying to remember now, I think that was Domino's. You've seen the film, right?
Yes, but not in a long time.
Okay. It's pretty early on, and there's they have their first battle pretty much in the opening scene, and they all get back to their headquarters, you know, in the sewer, and they get this this sort of lesson, I guess, this sort of epilogue from Master Splinter, and then it's dinner time, and they order a pizza. I'm going on way too long about this damn product placement, but I think it was Domino's, so that was the product placement for the film.
Yeah,
but I remember Pizza Hut. No, that was they had something.
I remember
some sort of contract
commercials, but. What was I just going to say? The pizza was a big part. The way those guys looked in those movies,
yeah.
I remember as, like, there's never really been something that looked like that special effects-wise. Like, it was real practical. They pretty much just built turtle suits, right? Like,
yeah, yeah. In the first two or three movies, they were guys in suits. They, in the first one, I remember specifically, I mean, was it Donatello who was voiced by Corey Feldman? Yeah, yeah. And I forget who Raphael... Well, Corey Feldman was in everything in 1989.
Yeah.
Raphael was voiced by someone, I think, fairly recognizable, too, but I forget who it was. And then, of course, in the costumes were people with martial arts experience and everything. Yeah, but they were pretty great costumes.
Yeah, no, they looked interestingly real. Like,
yeah.
They were bulky, but not weirdly. Like, they didn't look like mascots, even though they should have. Like, everything about the idea sounds like, oh, they're going to be high school mascots. But they, like, made it so that they...
So that we wouldn't see their eyes and their mouth.
Exactly, yeah. Like, they could have easily been, like, Disney World characters. But they kind of really went for it. It was interesting.
They had expressions and everything. I guess this was sort of the end of the puppetry stage,
mm-hmm.
you know, which sort of, I guess, began with the original King Kong, and this was sort of the end before things started progressing and evolving into computer
gen.
Yeah.
Because now they're totally CG.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Fighting, hanging out with Will Arnett or whatever they're
yeah.
doing now.
And that's coming along now, too, because it almost seemed like when the CGI thing began in the late 90s, I guess I would say, it looked like hell. It looked, you know, it again, it was like starting all over again.
Even like, if you go back and watch like Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone or like the first Tobey Maguire Spider-Man, it's horrifying.
That's
like,
true. Yeah, you notice the difference already.
It's really bad. The first Harry Potter, the first Quidditch scene they ever do is like on Waterworld.
I haven't seen it since it came out.
It's like a YouTube movie. Like, you're like, how did everybody fall in love with this? Like,
what was it? Would you say it was Peter Jackson and his Lord of the Rings trilogy that sort of changed things?
That and I always go back to 1993. Jurassic Park looks better than some things that come out today.
Let's talk about that, because that you can still watch Jurassic, and they were puppets.
Yeah,
they were machines, and you can still watch Jurassic Park. And
they did some CG blending towards the end, but for the most part, they built the animatronics.
Yeah.
And now that is sort of the style to like blend it.
Yeah,
but 1993 looks so much better. Harry Potter, I think, was 2001 was the first one, and it it looks like
a
complete reverse.
Yeah, but that was, Steven Spielberg doing what he did in 82 with E.T. and in 75
with
for Jaws. Yeah.
Yeah, especially with Jaws.
Mm-hmm.
Jaws was that big one because everyone thought he was a TV director and like couldn't handle a big summer movie,
right.
And then Jaws.
He made a shark.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Jaws is so good. Jaws
it
holds
is.
Up like so
it
perfectly.
Does. Yeah, and you see, like, footage, you know, like, cut footage, or you when you see photos of Jaws when he's not on, you know,
it's
just
so
a prop. Still looks real, though. It just looks like he's resting.
He's just hanging out. Or like at the Universal ride, you ever go on that boat where they...
Is that still a thing?
No, they took it
away. Yeah,
they replaced it with something else, but for a while you'd be like on a boat tour of the town.
It used to attack.
And it would attack the boat and like your guide, because all the people that work at Universal are like actors on some level.
Yeah.
So they'd like have pull out like a shotgun from under the thing and be like pretending to like fight the shark.
Yeah,
so funny.
Yeah. Well, now, going back to the Ninja Turtles, I think it was Jim Henson who was behind...
Oh, was that a...
I'm pretty sure it was, at least behind the first of the team. He died, you know, he died around that time,
mm-hmm.
but I think he was at least behind the first one.
Makes sense. I mean, he was the puppet's
He was
master.
The guy, yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I guess that sort of set it off. The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles... They were the heroes of my time. I mean, I was a kid when these new superheroes had arrived.
Uh-huh.
You know, we'd already had these, you know, Spider-Man and Superman and Batman, but then these were the superheroes of the 80s. And I remember much of the 80s, and... I guess I could relate with them. Just they were teenagers. They weren't really interested in girls or women. They were more interested in pizza and skateboarding. And,
I can relate to that too.
Yeah,
at a certain point.
Like I'm interested in pizza and skateboarding, and they also, like New Yorkers, they spent much of their daily lives beneath the streets.
Yeah, that's very true. Well, what was the deal with April? Did they all love April? Was she just around?
She was just around. I don't think anyone was trying to get in her pants.
No, well, they are turtles, so I guess.
That's true. You have to consider that they, at the end of the day, whether they were full-grown pizza-eating, you know...
Maybe April just wasn't into it.
I remember she made a Harrison Ford reference in the first movie. So she had her eyes set on other...
There's human men that April wants to go after more than anything.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. But, yeah.
They did two of those original style movies, right? It was that and then Secret of the Ooze.
Secret of the Ooze, and then there was the third one in which they time traveled to ancient... Japan.
The logical jump from
The second and third were so bad.
I mean, they were so ridiculous.
Yeah. But they had to make them.
Yeah. Well, of course.
Yeah.
And their target audience probably wasn't like, this is...
Exactly. No, we ate them up. We watched them. My friend, who lived down the street, you know, I remember we watched those films, even the second and the third, daily. So, you're right. We were seven. We didn't care.
No, they were great. It was just more turtles. Yeah. That's all it needed to be. It was just like, they're doing something we haven't seen them do.
We loved their stupid jokes.
Yeah, I bet. I bet looking back, there's like so much. I love sound effects from those era. Like, when they're fighting, I bet it's the most over.
Oh my god, yeah. Yeah.
Like.
Well, I watched them at least the first and second again, I think about 8 or 9 years ago. And yeah, they're just terrible.
Yeah. They're terrible in that right way of terrible, though. Like, I bet, like, it's like a nostalgic terrible. It's like, thank god I saw this when I was a kid.
Well, you know, the Turtles have always been campy, fortunately. They've always, and that was sort of, I think, the mission, at least with the comic books from which they originated. And then that cartoon. I think the cartoon came before the feature film. And it was a Saturday morning cartoon, which I think became an after-school cartoon. But again, if you go back and watch that, it's campy. And there are a lot of inside jokes, and there's a lot of absurdism, and I don't want to say surrealism, except, again, let's go back to that moment that changed my life.
They would break the fourth wall sometimes, yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean, first of all, you're stuck, and there's a bomb that's about to go off, and you're tied up, and you're stuck with this bomb, and it's a time bomb, and the clock is ticking, and somebody points out that you've got 10 minutes to defuse the bomb, or you're all going to die. Again, original writing. But what was great was that when Raphael said, oh, does that include commercial breaks? Again, it still blows my mind, and it's still the most wonderful thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
I think that's a nice full circle on the Turtles. I love that pick, and I love that fourth wall breaking was so big. Because I totally get it. Like, it's the same thing at the end of, like, I remember the first time I realized there was post-credit sequences was when Ferris Bueller tells everyone to go home.
Oh, yeah!
It's like, what are you still doing here?
Yeah!
Over! Leave! Like, we did this already. It's done.
I remember when I was maybe 20 or 21, I had been watching Ferris Bueller's with my girlfriend of the time, and I told her that I wanted just that post-credits scene to be played at my funeral. And she cried.
Oh, no. That's funny.
But I'm glad I could go on record and say it now that she's gone. She's married.
She was just like, couldn't think of death for even half a second. Like,
oh, God, no. I've only dated wholesome women.
That's so nice. But I'm so used to being around people that are just like, death.
I thought it was a great idea.
It's so funny. I feel like that's also a comedian thing. It's like, we've all thought about our own funerals, like, a good amount more than most people have. And there's always a bit involved.
So yeah. Like, it's sort of our last performance, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, go out with a laugh.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, please. Anyway, but yeah, it's that sort of thing, and I really remember seeing that for the very first time. I'm sure I've seen the episode since, but I remember seeing it the first time I saw it. And again, it changed everything. I felt like, oh my god, we're getting away with something, you know, like we're doing something forbidden,
yeah.
And that's comedy, isn't it? So maybe that was the beginning of how I ended up here.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. Yeah, everything about comedy, or like you said, breaking rules, it's so attractive.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it makes so much sense.
Yeah. Man,
that's a great first pick.
I thought this was a great idea because five things, but I could talk about this forever.
That's what always ends up happening.
Isn't it? Yeah.
I always, around a certain point, will like cut it, being like, knowing that like each segment is like 20-25 minutes.
How far in are we? 25 minutes in?
Yep.
Oh my god! Yes. I want to apologize to your audience. Okay.
Look,
we have to continue.
If Trevor gets 40 minutes on like Star Wars, anybody gets any limited time on anything.
Trevor will take 40 minutes on anything. Trevor, okay.
You'll hear this. Hi, Trevor.
Well, he's expecting me to say something about... Because I listened to the episode. He actually does a pretty good impersonation.
Yeah, it wasn't bad. When he busted it out of nowhere, I like was like, that was good.
Everybody's got one. Well, a lot of people have one. Yeah, I guess I'm sort of easy to impersonate. But and I have my favorites, I guess. But I guess I didn't realize what it entailed until I heard Trevor's, because he seems to pay close attention to the speed and the rhythm and the pitch. So I guess when I get excited about something, I'll speed up, and then I'll when I land on my point, my voice goes high, and that's what he did. So what was it about? Even I forget what he.
I don't remember.
I forget.
I'd have to hear back.
Oh, because he's one of the most interesting people.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what it was about. He's one of the smartest people you'll ever meet. And for months, I had only known him as this guy on stage who would talk about his manhood. And finally, one night, when I had a drink with... I was having a drink, or he was having a Coke or whatever, and you start learning about his time in China and his, and how he got into West Point, and he just reads and researches and watches everything.
Mm-hmm.
The guy just wants to learn anything he hears about. So yeah, it's always frustrated me because when he goes on stage and he talks about his dick, and so I think that's pretty much how he anyway.
All right. What's our...
moving on.
What's our next thing?
The Smothers Brothers.
The Smothers Brothers. Okay.
The Smothers Brothers. I can't just say that comedy as a whole has had an effect on me. I think it is some... I think it involves some very specific moments. So, beginning with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and a few years later... It was the Smothers Brothers.
Okay. If anyone doesn't know who the Smothers Brothers are, they should look them up right now. I've got to be one of the only people my age who would have instantly just lit up and been like, Smothers Brothers.
I'm afraid so.
But
yeah.
In film school, there was the whole, like the first part of TV broadcasting. That was what we did.
Really?
Yeah.
In what way?
We watched Smothers Brothers, I Love Lucy, Honeymooners... So much of that stuff.
Because they were groundbreaking.
Yeah, groundbreaking, yeah. And our teacher had an affinity towards comedy, like old TV comedies from like the 50s, 60s.
Mm-hmm.
That writing staff on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour.
Steve Martin,
Woody Allen,
yeah,
Rob
that's
Reiner.
Right.
Like,
Rob Reiner wrote for the Smothers Brothers.
Yeah, all these different people. Like, it was just a comedy. I can't imagine what those rooms looked like.
Would that have been... I mean, how much fun would that have been to have been? Anytime you watch a film with a great scene, I think I was most recently doing this with my brother Aaron with Bridesmaids, and I don't know what the scene was, but we'll say to each other, how much fun must that have been to be in the writer's room during that? And I guess maybe not so much with film, because there's usually just one or two writers. But if you take a TV show where there are multiple writers, whether it's a late night show or I Love Lucy,
mm-hmm.
which, again, I suppose we should say to your audience, although they've probably heard of, maybe more have heard of I Love Lucy than there have been to have heard of the Smothers Brothers. But still, I wonder how many people have... done their homework and revisited. Yeah, and sat down and watched these episodes, because I Love Lucy is genius. It's
so funny.
Still genius.
And
yeah.
You can see where every sick, like everything that's come after it,
mm-hmm.
there's such a clear progression from Smothers Brothers and I Love Lucy.
Yeah.
Like every Saturday Night Live doesn't exist without the Smothers Brothers. Every sitcom doesn't exist without I Love Lucy.
I'm so glad you just said that. Yeah. Smothers Brothers. The Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, which was a show sort of along the lines of a variety show,
mm-hmm.
in the 1960s, was really the first show on American television, and I believe they were on CBS.
Yes.
Okay. They were the first show to really do satire. And, yeah, we had had The Tonight Show for 15 years or so at that point. But we still weren't getting satire. We still weren't getting comedians on network television, you know, having fun with the administration, you know, or anyone in the government. And, I mean, the Vietnam War was happening
Vietnam
at this time.
Vietnam was their big thing.
And it eventually got them pulled.
Yes, CBS couldn't handle it anymore.
No.
There was a guy, if I remember from class correctly, there was a guy who went on and sang a song. I forget exactly who it is, but it was a very big person at the time. Something about the big money.
Oh, what was his name? Was it Harry Belafonte?
It could have been. It was a big singer of the time, sang a very anti-Vietnam song
on the air,
and then CBS was like, guys, God, like...
Yeah. And they specifically would call out Nixon, and I don't think, I wasn't around for him. I barely remember him being alive, but he wasn't a very good sport, was he?
From an historic sense. Yeah, he strikes me as not a great sport.
He didn't like people who didn't like him, but...
He was the first president who probably directly had to deal with... like comics being on, going on TV and being like, like by Gerald Ford, I'm sure he's like, I get
who
it.
Are these assholes?
Chevy Chase is going to fall down.
Wasting my time.
Yeah, but to him, he's like, really? Like, 200 years of perfect respect to have these dudes go on TV and call me an asshole. Like,
it's so true that we would not have Saturday Night Live.
Not at all.
And I think our friends over at Saturday Night Live would be among the first to admit that. Mm-hmm. And not to mention John Oliver. Mm-hmm. Seth Meyers, and of course, you look at these guys, Trevor Noah, who's doing a fantastic job, and Jon Stewart before him. You wouldn't have any of these guys if not for the Smothers Brothers.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if we did some research if Lorne Michaels was involved in some way.
With the Smothers Brothers.
He was a sketch guy. I know he was in Canada. He might have been...
Yeah, he was still in Canada in the 1960s, if I'm correct. But he was working.
Yeah. He used to be an actor, which was hilarious.
Yeah. But he was pretty young in the 1960s, because when Saturday Night Live first aired in 1975, he was still in his 20s. Mm. Holy, doesn't that just piss you off?
Sometimes it's all the ages of people, it blows my mind sometimes. Yeah, go for it. Yeah, like the ages some people are, even most recently, I'm the same age almost to the day as Pete Davidson from SNL right now.
He's a kid.
And he got on when he was 19.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what made me start doing comedy, because in my head it was something that grown-ups did, and then all of a sudden someone my age gets on the premier comedy showcase, and I was like, well, I have no excuse. I have to... And then you start reading about how, like, Dave Chappelle was sneaking into clubs at 13 and, like, doing it.
Eddie Murphy was 18 or 19 when he got on Saturday Night Live. He's around the same age as Pete Davidson, subsequently, when he did his first special.
Yeah. It's mind-blowing. It's like, so... You also have to take it out of that.
Yeah. Like, yeah, otherwise buckle up, because this is the first of many experiences like that that you will have.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, now it's... this is the first season where I'm older than everyone who plays college sports, and those guys are, like, physical specimens. Like, they're all 6'9", and look like... That looks like me, but I'm older than those people. It blows my mind.
You know, I just got into college basketball like 2 years ago, and I'm 33. So that's okay. And I'm
this
really
is just the first season.
Yeah,
like, I loved it my whole time.
Yeah,
growing up, and they looked like I was like, oh, that's what a 21-year-old
they're still kids
might look like.
Yeah.
And then when I'm 21, I look like I'm in middle school, and these guys are like professional athletes. Yeah, that one got me good. But we go back to Smothers Brothers. Do you have sketches that stand out in your head?
Yes, yes. The Smothers Brothers are the second among the five most influential occurrences or things in my life because... of a specific moment. So I guess it's only fair that we talk about that specific moment. When I was in the sixth grade, we had to have an indoor recess. It was raining outside. In most cases, do you remember indoor recess?
Of course.
It was a teacher's worst nightmare.
Yep.
Looking back on it, you didn't realize it when you were a kid, but yep. Looking back on it, no educator wanted for there to be indoor recess. Because it's the one time during the day where you can't discipline the kids, and yet they're still in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So we just run crazy. So my sixth grade teacher, who still to this day was one of the best teachers I've ever had, and I remember so much from his class, Mr. McKeachy. Mr. McKeachy decided that, okay, well, if we're going to have indoor recess, I'm going to show a film.
Just to try to save himself.
Exactly.
From the storm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there was a little bit of anarchy to him. He was a little bit of a revolutionary. And I mean, he always was with his style of teaching. And so it wasn't any different when it came to showing a film. He recognized that it was still recess. So he wasn't going to show us a slideshow. You know, that he would, you know, otherwise show during science or what have you. So he showed us this recent at the time, special that the Smothers Brothers filmed with the Boston Pops Orchestra. And again, this was one of those moments where I felt like rules were being broken, because I'd never seen the Smothers Brothers. I did not know who they were.
Mm-hmm.
They had this show in the 60s, you know, long before I existed, and then the show was pulled off the air. I didn't know who they were, and it was sort of this reunion, but with the Boston Pops Orchestra. They were in tuxedos. It was in this ballroom sort of setting, you know, people at tables with white tablecloths, and everyone was dressed up, and you know, just for those who are not familiar with the Smothers Brothers, it's they're folk singers.
Yeah.
And first of all, when they open with a folk song, they're actually playing a folk song, whether it's Cabbage or they call the wind Mariah or whatever it is, and they're actually playing and singing that song with heart.
Mm-hmm.
So you're actually getting a real genuine folk music concert, as you might have in the 1960s.
Yeah. So cool.
But then, in true Smothers Brothers fashion, and if you're not expecting it, oh boy, you're never going to get through an entire song.
Mm-hmm.
It's bound to be interrupted, in most cases, if not all, by Tommy Smothers, who is, I guess, known as the other one. There was Dickie, Mother Smothers' favorite son, and then Tommy, the other one.
Yeah.
So Dickie played the straight character, and they were actual brothers, and they're still alive. They must be in their mid 70s.
So, yeah, they're not there by now.
Yeah, and they're not touring anymore, as far as I know, but they're still alive, and I think at least Tom has a young family, I think. You know, so whatever's keeping him going. But, you know, this here we, for the first 5 minutes into this video, this VHS, you know, on this TV that was on a push cart that Mr. McKeachy had put in, we thought we were watching with this folk music, this duo on a bass and a guitar, with the Boston Pops Orchestra, and then suddenly things start to go awry, and the song gets interrupted, and then they argue, and then they argue some more, and it becomes hilarious.
Yeah.
And again, I thought, well, wait a minute, what about the Boston Pops? These guys just ruined the song. This is fantastic. Like, these guys are ruining the concert, and it's hilarious. And that was, that was really who, what can you say? I mean, again, that's what comedy is. That's
uh-huh.
sort of the magic of it, is that it's sort of an after hours, there's something forbidden about it.
Yeah, it's cool that this is another one where it's like, mm-hmm. there was conventions and then it got broken and it was like, the rest of the rules are meaningless.
Yeah, yeah. And again, you know, these two things. Now, in my lifetime, they've really shaped who I've become.
Mm-hmm.
These, you know... Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I had a teacher, a history teacher, that once, I forget what had happened, but every once in a while there'd be some event where every teacher was just showing videos in their class. I'll hand it to him, because I don't know that I'd be this brave. He took a room full of kids whose only perspective on comedy was Dane Cook and Family Guy.
Oh, no.
And then tried to play them Abbott and Costello. And, like, went through. And people caught on. There was definitely a large faction of people that were like, he hasn't said fuck once. This guy doesn't know funny. Because there's seventh graders. Like, what are they going to do? But it's fun. That just totally reminded me of that. I also love folk music.
Same here.
Like, even when it was, they were kind of seriously, or like, they had like Peter, Paul, and Mary on or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
They would have that. Every time I hear folk music, you ever see Inside Llewyn Davis?
Yes, yeah, that's a great movie.
Right before he starts his first song, he's like, if you've never heard it, but you've heard it a million times, it's a folk song.
That's
and
right.
then he starts playing, and I was like, I always think about that every time I hear Stevie.
That kind of folk music, I mean, the early 60s, Greenwich Village...
Such a cool time. So gritty.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Like, right early Bob Dylan.
Oh, I crave for that early Bob Dylan. I'm constantly listening.
How cool everything was. So much hadn't happened yet.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, you ever feel like we're kind of like, the way the world is, it's like it can't be like that anymore?
Yeah. Do you think about that? I think about that too much, I think. Yeah.
Like, so, well, I'm always worried that, like, I think that the problem is, like, if you spend all your time worrying you missed the boat, you, like, actually did miss the boat.
But it's important to worry, you know, or as we're saying these days, to be woke.
Yeah, just to be aware, like.
Yeah.
But then you get a bunch of those people, like, especially people, I heard a bunch of people all through college being like, I was born in the wrong year. I was supposed to be born in this, so I could have enjoyed this. And it was like, well... Maybe, but if that's true, that's a bummer. So, like, you don't even think about it. Like,
I think there's
nothing to be done about that.
Exactly. I think we do that to ourselves, or at least I wonder if we do. Because I constantly am being told that I was born in the wrong decade or generation, and I think that's just based on the way I dress, with the cardigans, the way I talk, and of course maybe the music I listen to, whether it's mm-hmm. folk music. I like the old Tin Pan Alley and the jazz from early American roots. excuse me, but that's a lot of that stuff is on the outside, because I still embrace the 80s. You know, I mean, that's a lot of that. I guess it's just where I came from. It was the decade, and you know, into which I was born, and so it's all there really was. I mean, it was what was there at the time.
Yeah,
you know, Star Wars and David Bowie.
Oh, that stuff is so cool, though. Like, I do have a tiny little bit of it, because I love the pop culture of the 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
I, like, really have spent a lot of time. People will sometimes guess that I'm older than I am just on my reference base.
Yeah.
Just the things that I'll talk about are, like, you know, it is a lot of 80s and 90s. And I think it's because the 2000s weren't that fun of an era.
You know, I kind of liked the 2000s.
Really? Just looking back on it, there's a lot of, like... There is good stuff, obviously, and the further away we get from it, I'm sure I'll be able to see.
Yes, yeah, you'll go back. Well, you'll revisit the music first, in my opinion.
I don't know that I will, because early 2000s music was like Limp Bizkit and Kid Rock. That's what that is, and then it moved into like Drake.
I think you're skipping a very important. chapter, because it was Limp Bizkit and Kid Rock. It was that rap rock
I always say that Rage Against the Machine is great, but every band they inspired is crap.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah, because I think that's absolutely what happened in the late 90s. If you weren't listening to pop, which was sort of a Latino influence.
Yeah, that was like Christina Aguilera was getting big.
Yeah. Of course, Jennifer Lopez and Enrique Iglesias and these guys. And that was the pop side. And then sort of the rebellious side, I guess it was... Unfortunately, what spawned from Rage Against the Machine, but it didn't go. If I may, it did not go from this rap rock, mm-hmm. this Uncle Cracker sort of bullshit. But to Drake immediately. In fact, I would argue that all of that entire genre, that late 90s, the Korn, the Kid Rock, that came to a halt because of the White Stripes.
Yes, okay, yeah, White Stripes, Franz Ferdinand, like that.
The Strokes, the Hives.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair. That was like the 2000s, and then Eminem was the biggest thing when I was growing up.
Well, again, he was late 90s.
Yeah, I think Eminem Show and Marshall Mathers were between 1998 and 2002.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah. Yeah, but I think music took a big turn.
I guess I was too young to appreciate that because they weren't, like, big radio-friendly, and, like, at that time
I was
only listening to the radio, I think, so I sort of discovered them in retrospect. The big thing that dominated the music in the 2000s for me was Green Day, because American Idiot came out in 2004.
Yeah.
And they were playing Giant Stadium the next year, like, they were the biggest.
That was a massive record.
Yeah, resurgence, especially because they were so big at one point, went away, and even bigger.
Do you think it has been able to stand the test of time?
American Idiot?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of the best punk records.
Still today?
I still think so.
Okay, but as a punk record, because I don't know punk as well.
Yeah. There'll be tons of people who will argue against it. I mean, punk fans are the worst fans ever.
There's so punk fans would argue against this?
Well, it depends who you ask. There's people, like, you have your bands, and then you have the bands that you think are just, like, posers or whatever. And, like, or sellouts. Like, sellouts is a big term.
Mm.
Like, the fact that Green Day's on a major label, or will play Giant Stadium, like...
Yeah, I would say that Green Day would be a sellout.
Yeah, they are the first band you could point to as sellouts, but I don't care about that so much as long as the songs are good. Like, I don't need... Part of it for me isn't that they're, like, living with 9 people on Avenue C doing heroin. Like, that's not...
okay.
Like, that's important to some people.
Right,
like,
right. Those are the songs. Punkers. Those are the...
Yeah, like, all the people that still live on St. Mark's Place, who still have not, like, gone from the...
Yeah.
They're, like, 40 and, like, chains and, like...
Particularly the ones who just live on the sidewalk.
Yeah, they have, like...
With a dog.
Yeah, they have a
There's always a dog, yeah.
And clothes that they bought from a thrift store in, like, the mid-90s.
Yeah.
That's not it for me. But...
Who elect to live off the grid, but in the middle of New York City.
Yes, it makes no sense. They're... If you really hate society that much, go to, like, Montana...
Well, that's living off the grid.
Yeah.
4 people live in Montana.
Yeah. You can have
4
a situation where your neighbor is 3 miles away from you.
Yeah.
That is off the grid.
Yeah.
It's a literal grid.
Honestly. You live between 7th and 9th.
Yeah, it's like...
Just between
there's no number
1st and 2nd.
Because you went to one of those without numbers doesn't mean you're off a grid.
Yeah. How did we get onto this? The music.
The music of the 60s, but Smothers Brothers.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, this isn't the show, though.
Like, you know what? We're just having a conversation.
When I started it, I was like, I want there to be topics in case we need topics, but it's nice to be able to, like, I don't like...
We can just talk.
Yeah, I don't like being
talk
like, well, we need to go back.
But, yeah. I mean, I hope I'm interesting, but your show is interesting to me, so
I'm sure people will love this one.
Well...
These have been 2 good picks so far.
The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Smothers Brothers.
If you have any, like, wrap-up thoughts about Smothers Brothers...
You know, the only thing is I regret not having seen them, because they are technically retired now, although they are both still alive. And so a part of me feels like, well, they had to come out of retirement at least once, but that's me being selfish. I mean, these guys have done more than enough than the vast majority of our species could ever do. These guys have changed, literally changed the course of comedy, and I would not be any kind of comedian if not for them.
Yeah.
And so I can't expect them to come out of retirement for me, nor can I assume they will, but by God, what I wouldn't give to just meet them.
Yeah.
Just for a minute. Just to thank them.
Because they're the influencers of people's influences.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, even if they never had a good sketch on the show, which they had hundreds of, launching the careers of two of the most successful directors and the best comedian ever is, like, enough. I can't imagine. And it's interesting that they never went on to do anything with the wild success of the people that worked for them.
That's true.
At one point. Like they're not in Woody Allen movies. Or, like...
They made records. Although, really, if you think about it, the records, for the most part, came out prior to the TV show.
Yeah.
They were in the 1960s.
That was like comedy records.
Yeah. Who is it? Is the podcast going to pick up the ambulance siren? Hey, that is legit. That is a...
hopefully it won't be too distracting.
We are in an apartment in Midtown Manhattan.
Yeah.
Are we in Midtown, technically, or...
People argue over what this is. This is Gramercy.
I guess it is.
But
we're in the 20s.
It depends who you ask, because sometimes people will be like, you're not in Gramercy, you're in Kips Bay. But then if you ask someone in Kips Bay, they're like, oh, fuck you, you're in Kips Bay. Like, right on the edge.
Well, we're in Manhattan, and we're not talking about Inwood or Washington Heights. Not to take anything away from Inwood or Washington Heights, but we're in a mess.
Yeah, we're in Manhattan.
You live in Manhattan.
That was sort of what I wanted when I picked the place out. Like, I was looking at places that were, like, maybe a little bigger or somewhere else.
Yeah.
And I was like, I think if I'm moving here for the first time, I want to be, like, in everything for at least a few months before I go out. And it's been interesting. I'm excited to move more closer to people I know. No comics live near here.
Of course not. We're broke. Where do they live? Brooklyn?
Yeah, Brooklyn, yeah. Queens. That's,
and then I live up in the Bronx. I live in
a lot of Upper Manhattan. Like, I know a bunch of people who live in, like, the 140s, 150s of Manhattan now.
Well, let me tell you. I can only speak for myself, but I'm happy.
I
love my neighborhood. I love where I live. I love going home to my neighborhood.
What train do you take?
Well, I hop on the Metro North because, well...
it's that first stop. The first stop on Metro North is in the Bronx, right?
Like, actually, no. The first stop is Harlem.
And
then it skips over the river. Into the Bronx, and then it rides along the East River and eventually along what becomes the Harlem River. And then it really goes all the way around, and then it heads west until it gets to the Hudson River at Spite and Dival. And then it heads north up the Hudson, and I'm the first stop after Spite and Dival, Riverdale.
Uh-huh.
And I live right by the train station, so it makes the most sense to me. Also, if we really want to get into it, since I suppose this is my first podcast, I have a pretty extreme case of obsessive compulsive disorder, including that of what they call mysophobia or germophobia.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't been on a subway train in a couple of years.
Okay.
I'm even if I don't sit down, I still feel
just
it's on me. Yeah. So I take the Metro North because it's a lot cleaner. But it's also fast, right? I like knowing what time the train departs.
That's great.
And what time it arrives. And it's like clockwork. I mean, it is set to that schedule. And if the train is a minute early, it will wait until, say, 8:38, mm-hmm. you know, and then it'll leave. So I know what time I have to be at the train station. And then it's nice. I mean, it's a spacious train. You can drink on the train. You can, yeah. So after my shows, maybe I'll have a cocktail on the way home. But nice. It goes along the Hudson. It continues on to something like Poughkeepsie or something. It goes way up.
Yes, it does.
Well, you know Poughkeepsie.
I took the Hudson Valley line all the time in college.
Because you went to college at Marist.
In Poughkeepsie, I could walk to the Poughkeepsie train station.
No kidding.
North, yeah.
So you went through my station.
Probably
Riverdale.
All the time.
Yeah.
It was a 90-minute ride from Poughkeepsie to New York City.
But I'll tell you, it is such a scenic ride.
It's so funny because you'll see a whole train of people sitting on the one side of the train where the wind is
on the river. Yeah.
Because otherwise you just see graffiti and like,
I mean,
fish kill.
You're
and, like...
yeah. But you're literally feet from the river.
The whole time.
Yeah. And you're just watch. Oh, my God. For anyone, any New Yorker, and you might not even have any obligations in Poughkeepsie, but just take
not.
The train.
Go to Hyde Park. Go to New Paltz. They're both...
Is that on the Hudson line?
No. Well, you have to take it to get there. Like, you go to Poughkeepsie, mm-hmm. and then you'll immediately find some sort of transportation away from Poughkeepsie into one of the surrounding towns, which
you know what?
Beautiful. But mm-hmm. Poughkeepsie itself still sucks.
I took my parents to Tarrytown last December. They were visiting, mm-hmm. and I knew that we could just walk over to the Riverdale station and hop on and go north to Tarrytown. And I was able to introduce them to great restaurants, mm-hmm. good coffee shops, and I wasn't able to take them, but there is an incredible concert venue, the Tarrytown Concert House.
Yes. There's two. There's comedians go up into Tarrytown sometimes too.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Jeselnik, I saw him in Tarrytown once.
Like, was he playing at the concert house?
No, it was what's it called? I want to say it's called the Circle.
Nope. No kidding. Okay, I don't know.
But that could be wrong. But there is a place where like comics will go.
Okay.
Up in Tarrytown.
See, I should know that. I know the concert house because I'm a music lover.
Yeah.
So I have attended concerts at the concert house. And it's like, it was built in 1880 or something like that,
mm-hmm.
and it's still a working concert house, and I can't imagine they've updated it, really, since the 19th century.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking like Preservation Hall, New Orleans, but it's an 800-seat theater. And I saw Nico Case there last March.
Oh, that's cool.
And she loved it, too. She gloated about it. She really celebrated it. It's a wonderful venue. But we should be moving on. I know. We're getting
off
track.
It's all good stuff. The third...
Okay, so that was Smothers Brothers. Yes,
yes.
We talked about... The influence that the Smothers Brothers have had. Okay, a little more broad... not as specific as, you know, the indoor recess with the Smothers Brothers or the breaking of the fourth wall with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but a little more broad, David Letterman.
David Letterman.
Again, this is... This is an ingredient to the making of a comedian. And again, I wouldn't be any kind of comedian.
Mm-hmm.
If not for this, not for the Smothers Brothers, and if not for David Letterman, he's everything to me.
I've heard so many people that I like. David Letterman was a huge influence on so many people that I see as influences. And I think it's funny. This is the second late night host that's been picked on this show, and I'm wondering if eventually I'll be able to get all of them.
Who was the first?
Conan.
Oh, that's great.
Late Night with Conan O'Brien, someone.
Yeah, who said that?
I think it was Trevor. But
no. Was it?
Yeah, I think Trevor talked about
it. He did! He did!
Late
You're
Night
right.
Conan
yeah.
O'Brien.
At least I think he did.
Yeah, and I think it's a funny, like, you could tell how, it's like Saturday Night Live cast.
Mm-hmm.
Like, whoever your late night guy is,
yeah.
says a lot about how old you are, because mine's Jimmy Kimmel.
Well, he was influenced by Letterman.
That's like on Letterman's last night. I remember all the other late night hosts.
Oh my gosh, we're
not doing shows. Go watch Dave's last show.
If I'm correct, Kimmel showed a rerun that night.
And with a message up top saying, I'm showing a rerun because you should be watching Letterman.
And Conan, first of all, that's admirable. I mean, you have to hand it to Jimmy Kimmel. Uh-huh. Anytime anyone foregoes the business, part of the business, and specifically honors the art and respects the influence.
Yeah.
That's admirable. And Jimmy Kimmel did it with, again, running the rerun. I thought Conan's was hilarious. Do you remember what Conan did?
No.
Anyone listening has to just, when this is over with, YouTube, when Conan was airing his show the night Letterman was airing, because Conan comes on at 11 with his TBS show, and Letterman would come on at 11:35. The Late Show with David Letterman would come on at 11:35. So, 35 minutes into Conan, with Patton Oswalt as his guest, he said, okay, we're being told that it is 11:35. Switch to Letterman. And he gave his television viewing audience about 10 seconds to switch to Letterman, which, again, is insane when there's a major corporation trying to make money.
Yeah.
We really don't... It seems easy enough, but you don't consider, you know, how much the suits have an influence on what you can do and what you can't do. And Conan said, we're doing this. We're going to tell our audience to change the channel. But what was great about it was after that 10 seconds, Conan said, okay, we can do whatever the hell we want now. And the 15, 20, 30 seconds that followed between Conan and Andy and Patton Oswalt, I think are among some of the best moments in television history, because it was just these grown men dumping coffee on the floor and making,
freaking out,
tipping things over. We can do whatever the hell we want. Which has always sort of been Conan's approach.
That's
isn't
his whole thing, yeah.
Oh, God, isn't he great?
So, Letterman.
Letterman. And Conan was the first person to succeed David Letterman.
Uh-huh.
And I grew up, really, on Conan O'Brien. But the thing is, there are a lot of aspects to David Letterman, between his late night show and, of course, the Late Show with David Letterman. And I remember the Late Show, of which he was the first host.
Mm-hmm.
That was his show, and it's now hosted by Seth Meyers, who's carrying it masterfully. But... what I remember, let me tell you this. I was alive for almost a third of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson, if you can believe that. But the only thing that I truly remember about Johnny Carson is that my neighbor, Pete, who is my brother Brad's friend, and he would come down. He lived up the road, and he would come down for dinner, usually on pizza night. And I remember he had an apparently uncanny impression of Johnny Carson. Looking back on it, I think everybody did. Excuse me. But I remember my neighbor Pete did, when I didn't know who else had an impersonation of Johnny Carson. And my dad would always have Pete do this impression of Johnny Carson. So that's one of two things that I remember about Johnny Carson. The other thing I remember is that David Letterman followed him.
Mm-hmm.
So... whereas I don't remember really, The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson. What I do remember is, you know, or rather was this goofy, gap-toothed guy, you know, who would strap thousands of Alka-Seltzers to his body and then be lowered into a pool of water. I remembered him in Stupid Pet Tricks. You know, these are on nights when I was awake because I was only 8 or 9. And then he got his own 11:35 spot on CBS. And then that changed everything for me because, you know, he was still there as I was becoming a comedian. He was there not only through my adult years, but into my, not only my high school years, I should say, but into my young adult years. And then when I realized, you know, that I might be a stand-up comedian, I would watch David Letterman, I would study his posture, I would study his delivery, you know, when it was okay to laugh, when it was okay to you know, to sort of be impatient or whatever it was with what he was doing. He was very original, and yet at the same time, I think he would credit his success almost exclusively to Johnny Carson.
Oh, for sure. I've always been curious, what about Letterman was different? Because by the time I was aware of The Late Show with David Letterman, there was Conan, there was Leno, there was, I think it was, yeah, it was Conan, Leno, Craig Ferguson had a show.
Yeah.
By that time. So what about Letterman was so, like, this is new and...
Letterman would throw stuff off the roof.
he was like the punk rock
that
guy.
That was it.
Like, Johnny Carson was the straight-laced guy, and he was, like, his, like... Letterman, I'm gonna do the things that Johnny would never do.
Let's see how many guys in a Spider-Man costume we can get into a Jamba Juice. Or, you know, we've got some odd thousands of ping pong balls. Let's just dump them off the roof. Because who doesn't want to watch thousands of ping pong balls fall onto 53rd Street at once?
So he was this guy that was just like, if we have, I'm the crazy idea guy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you have a crazy idea, I'm the man to make it happen.
Yeah, he was kind of a kid. He just wanted to see what. I mean, there were times when they just took watermelons, and let's just drop some watermelons off the roof of the Ed Sullivan Theater. Yeah, he really was. I mean, that was the Late Show. And yeah, Conan definitely took that and ran with it, with the vomiting Kermit and the masturbating bear. But, and how fun was that?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Late night. Oh, my God. But,
The show Rick and Morty had an episode very recently where a bunch of zany characters all sort of came in, and at one point, two walked in, and it was Amish Cyborg and Hammer Eye, a samurai that was made of ham. And the main character looked around, he's like, what is this, Conan in the 90s? Like,
I guess because he really can't do that at 11 o'clock, can he? I mean, Conan was so fun.
Yeah,
and he still is, because you still have Conan, who
Andy.
Naturally... Oh, my God.
I love Andy.
They're vaudevillian, and they're very much inspired by vaudeville. Letterman was sort of a mixture of all of those components, and I think it also helped that he was Midwestern, and maybe that's where I tap in. I mean, these guys like Letterman and Jack Parr and Dick Cavett.
Mm-hmm. You are from Michigan, if we haven't.
I'm mentioned. From the Midwest. Yeah, if we haven't mentioned it, I'm from just outside of Flint, Michigan. And Johnny Carson, too, was from Nebraska. And I'm not the first person to say this. I think this was brought up on the New Yorker podcast with David Letterman. He made, so I'm quoting the host of this podcast, but David Letterman made New York City feel like a small town. And it's so true, though, because, you know, we'd check in with Rupert G. at the Hello Deli. Yeah, we would check in. He would check in with people. He made everyone familiar. He made everyone in New York familiar. You know, let's see how many guys in a Spider-Man costume can we get? And it was the local Jamba Juice. Everything was the local this or the local that. Mm-hmm. And yet it was New York City.
Yeah.
But it was great because he was broadcasting to all of America. And that was the brilliance of him. So that was so important to me, I think, because, you know, whereas I had been developing as a comedian, I guess, before I even knew it, you know, with the influence of my prior mentions, Letterman, I guess, began to shape it, and he began to really, I guess he was the first person I really began to study, and I guess more importantly, I would also say that he helped strengthen and even encourage, in the first place, a bond between me and my father, my dad. And I'm probably not the first person to say that.
No, that's an amazing thing about entertainment, is I think that there's a lot of father-son relationships that are sort of grounded... Mm-hmm. In that, my dad, the two things that we have always connected over are movies and the New York Yankees.
You see, and let me go as far as to say that my dad and I have bonded over David Letterman, with a side of Steve Martin and Paul Simon, mm-hmm. but also the Detroit Red Wings, our hockey team. So yeah, it's there's a team. And then this source of entertainment. And I'm sure David Letterman would be quick to note that, you know, before him it was Johnny Carson who brought a lot of sons and fathers together, or daughters or whoever. But, you know, my dad and I maybe naturally wouldn't have had a lot in common.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know... That said, there are also kids who have grown up without fathers or father figures. And maybe I just got lucky, but someone like David Letterman comes along. I didn't do anything. My dad didn't do anything, but we have David Letterman to thank.
Mm-hmm.
And during his last season, 2015, that was when he retired. Around January, February, I requested for tickets to the show. I had just moved to New York City by that point, and I put in a request for a pair of tickets, and I got a call in late April saying, "Hey, if you can be in Midtown on either, you know, one of these two or three days, you know, you won the lottery." Literally, they're saying you won the lottery. And my dad, who's back in Michigan, was the first person I called because I knew he'd be the only person that I could think of who would really appreciate this.
Yeah.
Because my dad also loved David Letterman. And he and I, we wouldn't have the relationship that we have if not for David Letterman,
mm-hmm.
with the addition of a few other components. And so I was asking my dad to fly to New York City just to catch a taping,
mm-hmm.
of David Letterman. And my dad, God bless him, and if this says anything about the kind of person he is, he sure as hell flew out to New York City. And it was on a Monday, if I'm correct. It was May 4th, 2015. So we're talking 2 weeks before Letterman's final episode. So there were some goodbye things that he was doing, and we learned the night before that the guest would be President Obama.
Wow!
So we not only got to see Letterman in the Ed Sullivan Theater, and my dad, of course, grew up watching Ed Sullivan.
Yeah.
On Sunday nights, and there we were in the theater, we got to see a sitting president speak. Will Ferrell did a bit, because Will Ferrell was originally the guest, but I guess he got bumped.
He's like one of the only people that can bump Will Ferrell showed up.
Yeah, one of the only people who could bump Will Ferrell showed up. But the Late Show people, you know, God bless them, they didn't bump Will Ferrell entirely. So he did a little bit from within the audience and as Harry Carey.
That's another Midwest state.
And again, we got to see President Obama sit down, and it was his last appearance on The Late Show. And it was really special. I know for both of us, I'm speaking on behalf of myself and my father, but I'll also say for me, I guess what had a sort of surprising impact, an unexpected impact was, this is my second glass of wine. what had the sort of a surprising impact or an unexpected impact was before the show, and you never saw Letterman live. He would go out and warm up the audience. Whereas most late night shows have a guy.
Yeah, they have their own warm up.
They have a comedian. Yeah, yeah. I think Ryan Reese does Seth Meyers. Yeah.
I've been to that one.
Have you? Yeah. You know, and I've been to a taping of Conan, and he's got his guy, but Letterman does it himself.
That's amazing.
It's amazing, and it meant that we got to see a side of David Letterman that the rest of us only know from the 1970s, and that was David Letterman doing stand-up. Mm. Here he was in his late 60s. It was 2015, and as far as I knew, David Letterman really hadn't done stand-up since his days at the Comedy Store in Los Angeles in the mid-1970s. Mm-hmm. And then out he came without the jacket, and he did 5 minutes, and he did crowd work, and he just talked about his weekend. But we got to watch David Letterman do stand-up before they went into show mode, because then you're filming a show and you got to start things over and you got the microphone check and you got to go to commercial. Mm-hmm. But before all that, it was just for us. It was just for the 300 people or so in the Ed Sullivan Theater watching David Letterman do a 5-minute set.
That's so cool.
It was the greatest thing. And you know, Jesse Eigner, who's a great local comedian, he saw Letterman on a couple of occasions, and he and I have both talked about that. And before he even asked me, he said the greatest thing about my experience to the Late Show taping was before they even began taping the damn thing. And I said mine too, because here he was doing a set. So it was very special to me on that level, and it was very special to me to be there with my dad, because I am very close with my dad, and I probably wouldn't be if not for David Letterman.
That's awesome. That's such a cool story. I agree a lot, too. It's interesting you brought up the best part of going to TV tapings are the parts that aren't TV.
Yeah.
I agree 100%. I've been lucky enough to watch Saturday Night Live get taped a couple times.
Really?
And the coolest part... Well, it's actually a very similar story. I forget what year. It must have been 2008. The New York Giants had just defeated the undefeated New England Patriots in the Super Bowl. And Eli Manning was going to host SNL. At the time, I am the biggest Giants fan in the world. I'm watching live. I stay up every weekend. Yeah. I'm in high school. What am I doing on Saturday?
How many high schoolers watch Saturday Night Live?
Not many. Almost none.
Really?
No, because they're all busy, you know, like, out doing drugs and fucking each other.
Oh, well, not me. I was doing neither.
I was at my house watching SNL on Saturday.
I have yet to do either.
So the announcement comes up. They're like, in 3 weeks, Eli Manning and his book is Rihanna. And I remember going and getting a piece of paper and writing, Eli, SNL, May 5th, we have to go. And sliding it under my dad's door.
No way.
So that the first
way.
Thing he would wake up to.
Yeah.
Little did I know, he had entered the ticket lottery.
No.
That season. And it just so happened that the tickets that he got to get were the Eli tickets. And we ended
no
up going and
way.
Watching Eli Manning's dress rehearsal. So they do two shows.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you get a half hour of extra
yeah.
sketches. And my two biggest memories are beforehand mm-hmm. and a deleted sketch. So, like, Keenan came out and sang with the band, who were incredible. They weren't, like, joke songs. He's just a great singer. And he was doing, like, Motown, and, like, they were going solo.
Oh, that's great.
Sudeikis comes out and does, like, 5 minutes of, like, here's what's gonna happen. You guys have shitty seats. Sorry about it. Like...
Yeah.
And then they do the Eli Manning thing, but there was a sketch that didn't make TV where Bill Hader and Fred Armisen were playing Cheech and Chong,
oh
but
God.
Eli was in the backseat, and he was their third friend, Richard, who hated weed. And it was just the relationship between Cheech Chong and Richard.
And this wasn't aired.
No, it never made TV.
So you got to
yeah,
have it.
It got cut. It's,
yeah.
You can't find this on the internet
no.
anywhere. It just existed in that room. And
for you.
And yeah, we
and a handful of other people.
Yeah, and me and my dad will still talk about it. So you remember Cheech Chong and Richard?
Is there some sort of force in the universe for fathers and their sons? Maybe not. It would sound selfish because, again, there are people who don't grow up with father figures. And again, I might not have had one if not for instances or people.
I think we're both
such
pretty
as,
lucky.
Yeah, I think so. And I guess it's important that we acknowledge that. Because, again, what are the odds that you would be able to have that?
Yeah. No, I love that we both have that experience. We both
yeah.
were very lucky.
So you and your dad were at this dress rehearsal, which would, again, never make it to air.
Yep.
So how intimate.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It's such a nice memory, and I love that. That's such a great pick, too.
I mean, again, Letterman has been everything to me. Every decision he's ever made, you know.
That beard he grew is crazy. Not that it's bad.
Have you seen him?
This is crazy. He looks like a totally different
he
guy.
He is retired.
Yeah, he really is. He's like, I'm retiring from everything.
God bless
shaving.
Him. I mean...
Why shave?
I shave for every show I do.
Yeah.
And that includes open mics. So, if you've got to be on TV every night for, what was it, 33 years?
Yeah, something crazy.
I can understand.
I mean, he saw the world change. He saw the world change a couple times.
Yeah, yeah.
It's pretty fantastic. Like, the people like that, that's fascinating. The people that get to be on TV for that long and have seen just all those
yeah.
things, like multiple wars, multiple changes of leadership, all this different stuff. It's crazy.
I mean, He had material on everything from the Berlin Wall to Monica Lewinsky.
Monica Lewinsky.
He was the first late-night talk show host to return to network television following September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he handled that... Again, I was 18 at the time, so I was pretty young, but that was masterful. And I learned so much from that. I learned so much from the way he handled... the scandal, the sex scandal.
Yeah. Well, he that was amazing because he just head on. He was like,
yeah,
I'm sorry, I'm not gonna.
He beat the guy to the punch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He like 8-miled his own sex scandal, kind of.
I'm sure that's how he would have put it too. Yeah. He has been one of the single most influences on my life, and more specifically, my life as a comedian. And he continues to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Comedy's response to tragedy has always been something that's super interesting to me.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
yeah.
Jon Stewart's first show after 9/11 was...
That was also... Yeah.
Yeah. SNL, like having Giuliani come out with Michaels.
Oh my god.
And all the firemen behind him. And Michaels asked him, hey, can we be funny again? And he's like, why are you going to start now?
That was funny. And then do you remember one of the first sketches they did? And again, this was weeks after 9/11. And one of the first sketches they did was a boardroom scene.
Mm-hmm.
I think
with Sean William Scott.
Sean William Scott was the host. And yeah, the unofficial rule, the agreement was to show your patriotism, as the entire country was during that time. And so to this boardroom meeting were characters with American flag pins and red, white, and blue ties, neckties. And what was Will Ferrell.
Yep.
Oh, my God. You know, who's never had the most appealing physiques?
No, Will Ferrell looks like a regular person.
Yeah, he looks like a regular person. Belly button hair and a couple of extra pounds.
Big guy.
And when he walked in with, you know, like the American flag thong, pretty much.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It was all he wore.
And no one in the cast can handle it. They're all just like looking right at the table, trying not to laugh. Oh, it's so good.
Wasn't that all you needed, though? Yeah. That said everything.
And it's
about,
so silly. It's
and it was okay.
Response.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It sort of, you know, it helped. Along with a few other things, I think The Onion as well.
Oh, they were great. Their headline right after 9/11, I think, was just holy fucking shit, with a picture of what happened.
That and terrorists surprised to find themselves in hell. And they had they had exclusive interviews with the terrorists from hell. But that was because we were... Rather, they, you know, these geniuses were sort of inventing the way of how we were supposed to respond, because no one really knew how to respond.
No.
And then so you had people like Will Ferrell and Saturday Night Live and The Onion sort of deciding how we should respond. And that was it. That was comedy. And... And even David Letterman, I remember him being funny that night. And of course, I also remember him. I remember him being terribly sad. I remember him being very and noticeably broken.
Mm-hmm.
It was clear, if I may say, that Letterman did not want to do the show since. Mm-hmm. And I'll say that considering he has since admitted that he did not want to do the show that night. But all of these components, I think, were essential in how it was executed. And again, Letterman was the first person back on the air since September 11th attacks.
Yeah.
And I thought he just handled it masterfully, as I'll say again.
Cool.
So
yeah, so wrap up thoughts on Letterman.
That's just it. Nutshell, I think forever that episode will have an impact, and who he has been, the kind of comedian he has been, and of course, again, the personal experiences. More specifically, those of which have included my father, have had such an influence on who I am as a person and who I am as a comedian.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right,
thanks.
We're going to take a quick break and stuff so I can pee.
Oh,
That's really all the breaks ever are, if anyone's ever wondered.
Because when we come back, there will have been no commercial,
no,
right? It's just going to be...
Every time, I'm like, I don't know why I announced it, but I'll be honest with you people. I'm just going to go pee real quick.
Go we'll pee, right and back. We will see you in 1 second. What happened?
We stopped,
Did it stop?
Yeah, it stopped for a second. We're going to have to circle back.
Okay. Well, we haven't... Gone. We haven't moved on to
the fourth thing.
Yeah,
no, we mostly just were talking.
Yeah,
kind of inside baseball.
You'll just
comedy.
Have to edit this.
Yeah, I will just have to edit.
You've
this.
Just got some homework to do. That's all.
No, we just lost like 5 minutes.
Okay, that's okay because we were just talking about sex scandals.
Yeah, we were mostly just talking about Cosby and
yeah, we were
scandals.
It automatically stops recording once you say Cosby. It just stops. So.
Or like, I have a UZB sticker on that computer. I'm sure I've given them enough money where I'm sure
they're, they're getting a live feed.
Yeah, do not talk about our recent scandal. All right, so I guess that's a sign we should get right back into the show. All right.
So number four, and we're moving in chronological order.
Yes.
All right. Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Ann Arbor.
Ann Arbor is a college town in southeastern Michigan.
Michigan State.
University of Michigan.
University of Michigan. Mm-hmm.
It's about 35 miles west of Detroit.
Uh-huh.
So I had been doing improv in Chicago throughout all of my 20s.
Were you living in Chicago at the time?
Yeah. I grew up in Michigan, but I moved to Chicago when I was 18, right after high school graduation.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed...
College?
I didn't go to college.
No?
Until recently.
Oh, yeah?
I'm a 33-year-old undergrad.
Oh, that's
yeah,
awesome.
Yeah. Which is why I'm really into the NCAA basketball. I go to Manhattan College, and
So that's now. I knew you were.
I have a class with Xavier Turner, who's on the team, and that's why I root for these guys. That's why I love college basketball, because this, I know this guy. He's kind of a ham.
And they're one of the two good teams in the Metro Athletic Atlantic Conference. Manhattan and Iona are the only two that ever
are
compete.
They? Well, yeah, Iona's great.
I went to Marist, who wins an average of 8 games
yeah,
a year.
Yeah.
So comparatively...
Manhattan had a tough season, but I think they're going to be really good next season.
Iona is always the one that gets the
god
MAC bid.
Damn Iona.
Yeah, right? Fuck Iona.
Oh my god. They're always, always just a
every year,
thorn in our
and they
side.
They always end up getting a 13 seed and losing to somebody like Purdue.
Hmm. Well, let me tell you about, I moved to Chicago because I wasn't ready for college, first, and second, I knew that I wanted to work in comedy, but mm-hmm. I just wasn't sure, you know, to what degree.
Uh-huh.
So, Chicago seemed like the easy choice, and I will say that maybe Chicago deserves an honorable mention here. But I spent, I guess, 11 or 12 years in Chicago, and I spent all of them failing. So when I look back at my time in Chicago, I feel as though I overstayed my welcome. I feel as though there are no good memories to come from that time. I feel like I wasted my 20s and thus a major chapter of my life. Because although I did sketch and I did improv and I was... hired by the Second City eventually, it wasn't enough, and I should have known that long before I was hired by the Second City, before I was hired by IO, formerly Improv Olympic. I guess I was enough to get hired as a musical director, I should specify, but I wasn't even that good of a piano player. Let alone a performer.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to be. Either that or I just didn't want to accept that I wasn't good enough. So I stuck around until I was 30. I didn't leave Chicago until I was... I just turned... It was right after my 30th birthday. It was right around the same time. So to me... Chicago has always been just another Midwestern town.
Uh-huh.
But in their defense, I guess I should say the people who live in Chicago love Chicago.
Oh my God, yes.
Because otherwise, you have to move on, as I did. you've got to go to one of the coasts, whether it be
New York or LA.
New York or LA, exactly. If you're staying in Chicago, it's because you have embraced that town. And that goes for a lot of Midwestern towns, whether it be Chicago or Kansas City, which is another great town. St. Louis, a great town. But you know, you're not going to amount to the fame and fortune, if you will, that you want to amount to if you stay in these towns. But that means if you stay in these towns, it's because they're special to you and you love these towns. And as an outsider, I can say Chicago is a great town for, I think above all, in particular, two things, food and music. Chicago, Illinois is a great town for food and music. And again, the people who live there, they live there because they don't want to be in New York.
Yeah,
and they don't want to be in L.A. And you know, and if you look at it, the people in New York and L.A. are, you know, a lot of us are transplants,
yeah,
such as myself.
Did you ever get involved in the stand-up scene at all in Chicago when you were there?
I tried once or twice.
The Chicago had, in the last 10 years, like, everybody came out of Chicago, it seems.
Yeah,
like.
Yeah.
TJ Miller, Pete Holmes, Kyle Kinane,
mm-hmm,
Kumail Nanjiani, Hannibal Buress.
Yeah.
Yeah, they all popped up out of Chicago.
I knew some of those guys.
That's cool.
I didn't know Hannibal. The first open mic I ever did, I was 18. It was in the back of a European football club on Irving Park Road. And it was hosted by a young 20-something Camille. Camille Nanjiani. He was the host. These guys all did. And TJ Miller was there. And John Roy was there, and Dwayne Kennedy, and Robert Buscemi, and all these guys did the show. And it scared the hell out of me. So I did one set, and then I didn't do stand-up again for about 10 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I guess I was around 28 or 29. I knew Beth Stelling from improv.
Mm-hmm.
I did improv with Beth Stelling. And we were also on a softball team together. And so Beth had me on her show, Entertaining Julia. And so I tried it again, and I thought, maybe I can do this, you know. And around that time, Twitter was coming out. Like, and I had gotten a Twitter account, and I'd begun sort of working out some material on Twitter. And I thought, well, maybe I can write jokes. Maybe this is it. So it was after doing one or two of Beth's shows. Beth's an old friend of mine, and so she was kind enough to have me on, even though, I wasn't that good. I had only done stand-up once or twice prior to that, and it was like 10 years earlier as a teenager in this European football club. But Beth was kind enough to have me on, and that was when I began to wonder, well, maybe I can do this, even though it wasn't that good at the time. I don't know if it's still that good, but you know, for the most part, I spent those 10, 11 years at Improv Olympic. I was on a couple of house teams. I worked in the box office for 5 or 6 years, and I played the piano for them because I could improvise on the piano. I could play by ear. But I remember there being shows where TJ Miller, because he was on house teams at IO, and TJ Miller, whoever, I don't know who would make him host, but he'd be the one to get the audience suggestion. But he would end up taking the opportunity to do a 5-minute set.
Yeah, of course.
And it would piss everyone off. Everyone would get so angry. I didn't care. I was just sitting behind the piano. I didn't have to play. But he would make it, he would take the opportunity to do a set. And again, it made no difference to me, but I never knew why people would make him the host when he was just going to use the stage time.
Well, that's so in line with what I've heard about TJ, too, and the split between improv and stand-up.
Yeah.
It's contentious. There's some bad blood between improv and stand-up.
Yeah.
In this city, at least. I don't know if it's like that
yeah.
in other ones, but
yeah.
people do not like... Like, if you do both, you're kind of like this weird... It's kind of like saying you root for, like, like the Yankees and the Red Sox. So you're kind of, the people are kind of like, what the fuck? Like, pick one side. The stand-up organization that we know each other through, yeah, hand out notebooks sometimes that say fuck improv on the front of them.
That's true. I don't like those notebooks.
I don't either, because we both have some history. Because it's, yeah, stupid. It makes you one makes you better at the other.
Yeah.
Being comfortable in front of people is a skill in it, but, like,
there's so much that I got from improv.
Excuse me. I couldn't do stand-up if I didn't do 4 years of improv first. People will ask me, like, how do you do this? How do you come up with material?
Yeah.
It's like, I got used to going up there with nothing. So, mm-hmm, going up there with something feels like I'm on, like, comedy steroids. It's like I'm cheating almost. I already know what I'm going to do.
That's true. Also, I think you and I write a lot of material that plays out like an improv show. I have a joke about how my dad falls asleep all the time now that he's getting older.
Mm-hmm.
And like an improv scene, it begins with just my dad who falls asleep.
A grounded reality.
And then I say, Dad, you fell asleep. And then he says, I was just resting my eyes. And then I say, either way, you're driving. And that's sort of the gift.
Yep. And now the reality that he's driving is there.
Yes.
It's true. And it's accepted by everybody in the room because that's the reality that you put out. That's improv.
Exactly. And I don't think I would have been able to write that joke if not for my experience with improv.
Because when because they gave you the gift of, like, I am a, yeah, person who falls asleep when they shouldn't, and then now you get to be like, where's the situation where that's
now
detrimental?
You
know. Driving. It's, yeah, so cut. Sometimes it's almost annoying how puzzle piecey comedy can be.
Yeah.
But when you really do take a step back, and improv allows you to see the puzzle pieces.
That's true. I agree with that.
Because you're building them one at a time with somebody else, whereas stand-up, you're kind of just like, well, I'm going to say my piece.
Yeah. Yeah.
Follow the funny. Don't force anything. Like,
yeah.
Improv has so many great rules. Learning how to, like, I don't know exactly the word for it, but learning what the difference between a joke and a shock is another thing that comes from improv.
Yeah, well, it's the sort of pulling the rug out from beneath. The gifts.
We've talked a lot about improv in
Chicago.
But I want to hear about Ann Arbor.
Yeah, because I won't credit Chicago. But again, I just want to reiterate before we move on that's my fault.
Everybody's got to figure it out. I mean,
yeah. And Chicago's a great, because I feel like I was destined to move on, and maybe I should have sooner than I did, but that's not to take anything away from Chicago.
I bet there were some fun times.
There were some fun times, and it's just, it is a great town.
Never been.
You gotta go. I mean, my favorite record store is still there. It's Dave's Records on Clark Street. My favorite food, I mean, the deep dish. I love the deep dish pizza. I know you're a New Yorker, but I love the deep dish pizza.
Yeah, I grew up on the classic pizza.
I love the deep dish pizza. I'm sorry, but
hot dogs are one of my favorite things in the world. So.
Well, you can get a good hot dog in Chicago.
I've heard that.
And then, I mean, you've got good baseball. You've got confines such as Wrigley Field.
Yeah. If the Yankees ever play the Cubs in Wrigley, I think the next time I'm going to try to make a trip.
I mean, it's a garden. It's a ballpark that still, I mean, it feels like the ballparks that you might have heard about or read about of yesteryear.
Yeah.
I mean, because you're really on the grass. I mean, you really are. I mean, you can practically talk,
yeah,
to the players. You can have a conversation because it's such an old ballpark. It's just that's how they were designed,
yeah,
when Wrigley Field was designed in the early 20th century.
I may be super biased, but the only old style baseball park I've ever been to is Fenway, and I thought it was crap. It was annoying. The seats were uncomfortable, not facing the right way.
Well, that's fair. Yeah.
Pillars, there's like, it's just,
yeah,
old and gross. My prejudice against Boston is super deep.
No. Because...
So, who knows?
Fenway is an old grandstand park, am I right?
Yes.
Okay, and I remember the old Tiger Stadium in Detroit, and that was similar. Obstructed views, uncomfortable seats. Whereas Wrigley Field was a little bit different. It's a little more spread out. It's a little smaller. It's a little more comfortable, But anyway, and I hope it's there forever. Of course.
It's the last one, really, right?
I think so, that and Fenway, yeah.
Yeah, well, Fenway, I think, has got plans to update. Like, they make so much money.
Yeah, super. Yeah.
And now that the Cubs finally won their World Series, they might be able to push renovations a little more, because it won't be like... We did win in this park. Like,
yeah.
It took us 105 years, but we did it. Like, now we can get some better seats or something. Like,
yeah, I mean, they've been updating a little bit.
They'll never get rid of the ivy, I hope.
I hope not.
Even though that's the most dangerous thing ever, because it's just brick behind the ivy.
Well, yeah. And people have run into it. But that's the thing about Chicago. Chicago recognizes the importance of... tradition to sports fans.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying tradition should be essential always. In fact, I don't think it should be. But when it comes to sports, I think it's okay if you are a sucker for tradition.
Mm.
You know, keep the original uniforms.
Yeah.
You know, keep the venue as long as you can. For some reason, that's important. And whatever that reason may be, I think that's part of what makes sports what they are. And again, maybe going back to how they bring us together with our parents, with our dads,
so
particularly.
Important. Yeah,
yeah. It's that. So, but anyway, so that's my.
We talk a lot about Chicago. What's special about Ann Arbor?
But Ann Arbor, Michigan, came when I finally realized that I had overstayed my welcome in Chicago.
Okay, so you moved there after Chicago?
Yeah, for me, I was supposed to be moving to New York. And New York had always been in the cards, even before I had moved to Chicago. And, you know, you turn around and you realize 11 years of your life have gone by and you haven't moved. And in my case, I was in Chicago. And I had always wanted to get to New York. So, one thing led to another, and there were enough of these incidents that transpired right around the time that I turned 30. This was, I guess, middle of 2013, that led to my departure, and I really just up and left, and I was coming to the realization. With the fact that I was not an improviser. I could not write or do comedy with other people. I could not I could not keep running back to the nurturing and comfortable confines of art by committee, and instead. and instead, because at the time I had begun writing my own material, and so I was realizing, by doing things my way, by doing things on my own term, and by being myself on stage, I was getting a little further ahead than I had ever gotten. So in June of 2013, I really. Up and left pretty abruptly. I left Chicago, and so abruptly to the point where I wasn't quite ready to move to New York. I hadn't the money, or resources or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
But I started heading east, and I ended up in Chicago. I'm sorry, I ended up in Ann Arbor. I'd left Chicago for Ann Arbor. And
how close is Ann Arbor to where you grew up?
About an hour and a half, maybe. It's part of this triangle. You have Detroit to the east, and then to the direct north, sort of between Ann Arbor and Detroit, is Flint. and it's this triangle of sort of major cities or large towns. Mm-hmm. But also a great music. Great music has come from these three towns. So Iggy Pop and the Stooges from Ann Arbor.
I wrote a research paper in college on the origins of punk rock, so I spent a ton of time writing about Iggy Pop.
So Ann Arbor, yeah.
MC5 and the Detroit.
All of Detroit and then Flint and my hometown and where my parents still live, just outside of Flint. But I went to Ann Arbor because I had spent some time in Ann Arbor mm-hmm. previously, and you know I knew that I had some connections there. I was able to get a job bartending at a place on State Street. But furthermore, my cousin Eric at the time was attending school. He was in the med school at U of M, at University of Michigan. He was in the med school. And Eric put me up for about 5 weeks before I was able to find a place. And this is my cousin. He's 7 years younger than I am. And so I was 30 at the time. He was in his early 20s. And you know, he was living in this place with two or three other guys, but they had a pull-out couch. And so they put me up on this couch until I was able to find a place of my own. And, you know, I had left Chicago feeling pretty defeated. I had felt like I was only a failure. I wasn't sure what the next year would bring, but I knew that it would either make or break me. And while I had my eyes set on New York City, and knowing that that could make or break me, I knew that I just had to get to New York to know what would become of me. Uh-huh. You know, and otherwise, I just had to survive Ann Arbor. So I spent a little less than a year there, attending bar, saving money for New York. You know, for the first 5 weeks of that better part of the year, sleeping on my cousin Eric's sofa. And I ended up, just as luck would have it, finding a place next door to my cousin. So
that's so funny. You just like walked outside one day and they were like, "Hey, this is for rent."
It was a condo unit, so it was one of those places with the courtyard and they were all connected with the aluminum siding and the fountain and the gazebo, you know. But I had my own place, but it was next door to my cousin. So after I moved in, we still spent the rest of that year getting together every night.
Yeah.
We would play backgammon. We would watch hockey. We would kill a bottle of wine. We would split a thing of cheese, and we would.
So classy.
We loved it. There was a Trader Joe's nearby, so we'd get the smoked Gouda, and we'd get a cheap bottle of wine in good Trader Joe's fashion, and then we would just watch hockey, or we would play backgammon on one of the picnic tables outside. And honest to God, it was one of the best years of my life, and I think, to his credit, maybe he really saved my life. Because I was able to keep on going thanks to my cousin, my younger cousin, Eric, who, again, was completing his degree as a med student there at the University of Michigan. And he's in Chicago now, you know, for his residency with the Loyola. If I'm correct, I think it's the Loyola Medical School. I could be wrong. But anyway, this was so important this year. Mm-hmm. And there was one comedy club in Ann Arbor, the Ann Arbor Comedy Showcase, and they had an open mic, the Comedy Jam, once a week. It was every Wednesday, and you know, you'd be in a lottery, so you were lucky if you got in the lineup.
Yeah.
But it didn't cost you anything. You could bring friends, and if you brought a lot of friends, then it would guarantee you more spots. And that's where I was able to really begin to hone my stand-up material.
Yeah.
It was at the Ann Arbor Comedy Showcase, and then eventually it led me to my move to New York.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Is Ann Arbor the one on the Great Lakes?
Ann Arbor is on the Huron River. It's about 40 miles inland. But it is, it's a college town. It's farmers markets and vegan restaurants and bookstores and record stores and recycling bins, and it's hippies and it's old hippies. Yeah. And it's a college town too, so it's educators and it's intellectuals, and you know, the critics will call it jokingly the People's Republic of Ann Arbor, but I love it, and I love that it is that town, sort of separated from reality, because really at the end of the day, I think this is maybe the kind of person I am, and I love that I can get farm-to-table food. I love that I can get vegan and organic food. I love that the local farmers are supported. And I did read recently that there are more bookstores per capita in Ann Arbor than there are in any other town in the United States.
Very cool.
And I love it. And they're used bookstores, and so they all have that smell. And
it's
you
the
can
best smell.
Oh, it's the best smell. And you can hang out for hours.
Books.
And
the smell of books.
My God. You drop the Moby Dick or the Tolstoy on the counter, and the person behind the register will want to talk to you about it because they're there because they love books. You know, and not to take anything away from, say, Barnes & Noble, but they might have just hired some high school kid who needs a few extra dollars. But the used bookstores, you know, the people who work in used bookstores, they are the intellectuals. They are the book nerds.
They
read everything, and they will happily and voluntarily talk to you about, you know, Hemingway or the significance, you know, of the old man in the sea is suffering with dignity, and whatever they get, Flannery O'Connor, you know, whom I was recently turned on to, and that's the kind of people who work and live in Ann Arbor, and that's the kind of town it is. Craft beer, just local businesses. I love that town so much. It brought me back down to earth. It sort of recharged my battery, and from there I was able to move to New York.
That's so amazing. I'm going to have to check that out.
You got to visit sometime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm ashamed of how few places I've actually been. I grew up in New Jersey. I live in New York. So I grew up 45 minutes from here.
I think New Yorkers never have any desire to venture to the Midwest.
Poughkeepsie is literally the farthest away from New York City that I've ever lived. Like, I've been in such this 100-mile circle my whole life. I've been thinking about it recently. My lease on this place is up in 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been very strongly considering moving to either Austin or Denver.
Really?
Because I've lived here my whole life. I would love to go to a mid-sized city. One that has a comedy scene.
Yeah.
The thing that stops me from doing it is that every comedian I've ever read their thing is they've always ended up in New York or L.A.
Yeah.
So it feels weird for me to start in New York, leave, and then come back. Yeah.
I gotta pee.
Oh yeah, totally. No.
So can we stop it?
Yeah, no, this is a perfect
I was
time for
trying to do this discreetly because I don't want to leave this subject.
No, 100%. We'll take a quick break and we'll
okay.
be right back.
Thanks.
Okay, cool.
So
quick bathroom break.
Yeah.
I feel like it'd be weird to leave New York and come back to New York.
Why is that?
I don't know. It might not be. There's just something in my head that's about, like, once I'm here. Like, I did a year of work here. I don't want to go to a new city, do all the same rebuild welcoming again, like, meet everybody. Like, you remember what it was like when you first started here?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was tough.
And I knew nobody. It's always tough.
Yeah.
And I feel like I might be a little spoiled. Like, there's this place, the Climate Lounge. I describe it to people I went to high school with as my Cheers now. I walk in and I know 35 people. They're all just like, oh, hey, it's you. And it's like, it's comfortable. And I'd be nervous to go somewhere else. And also, there's that thing where I don't know. But I've never lived anywhere else.
That's the thing. I mean, I'm 33, and I've had at least three or four of those places that come to mind already. So maybe it's important to introduce yourself and expose yourself to other people and other routines.
Yeah. Sometimes when I'm bored at jobs or whatever, I'll just look at apartments in Austin.
Really?
Texas, yeah, just to see what's up.
But why not? I mean,
it's fear.
Yeah, of course.
It really, it's really just fear.
Sure.
I've never lived anywhere else.
Sure.
I moved to New York City because I've been coming here since I was a little kid.
Yeah.
I went to Italy one time for 10 days and was miserable. And that's the extent of my life's travels. I went to Jamaica when I was like 9. I remember nothing except being scared. Here's what I remember about Jamaica. When you're driving and you stop at a red light, people will run up to your car and start smashing on your windows trying to sell you individual red stripe beers.
Jesus.
I was so scared. I had never... I grew up in an area that was as far away from what life was like as possible.
Yeah.
So I haven't traveled. I really don't know. I feel like I need to get away from New York City, or I'm just going to be one of those people that's like...
That's an experience, though. And within those experiences, you'll eventually meet people. You'll develop a routine. You'll find places where you like to shop. You'll find places where you like to go. You'll find places, you know, whether they're to relax or what have you. You'll find places where you like to drink and socialize.
I don't think that last one I'm gonna figure out.
Yes. Yeah. But it's always going to be hard. I mean, my first month in New York was very hard.
Yeah, no, it's got to be. Did you know anyone when you moved here?
No, no one.
Just cold? You were like, I'm coming here for entertainment.
So cold, yeah. Should that bring us to our final...
Yeah, no, this would be a perfect time to get into our final thing.
Because it is New York City.
It is New York City? Perfect.
It is New York City. Oh, my God.
This place is crazy.
I knew no one.
Had you been here before you moved here?
I... Kind of. I had... once I had begun writing for myself, I guess while I was still sort of doing improv and sketch and some musical direction... in Chicago, I was sort of on the side and I guess maybe secretly writing my own shows. And that was sort of, I guess, how I learned to write jokes. Between that and, again, Twitter. And I began writing shows for myself and subsequently began scheduling my own shows and began touring. And so I was doing the Philadelphia Fringe Festival in 2009. And it was my first time in New York because I had a show, on a Saturday night or whatever, and the next show wasn't until Sunday afternoon. And I had a friend who lived in the New York area. So I said, hey, I'm in Philadelphia. I've never been this close to New York. And I've never, as a reason, naturally never been to New York. And I'd love to go. I've always wanted to live in New York. Do you think you could meet me somewhere? And he said, sure. I didn't realize he was living in Connecticut. So I took the Chinatown bus in from Philadelphia. And he met me. He was late. So I arrived in Chinatown. I wandered and I walked, and I eventually found a bar in the East Village, you know, where he eventually met me. By that time, I was a couple of gin and tonics in. But but my first, and I think only night in New York up until that point, up until the time I moved here, I woke up in Stamford, Connecticut.
That's so funny.
He met me in the East Village with some woman, I guess his mistress, because she wasn't his girlfriend. And, and we all...
Oh, such a great first New York story.
And then I woke up in Stamford, Connecticut. And I thought, well, this is great, because it was a great night. Really, it was a great night in New York. And the next day I had to take the train from Stamford in back into New York, because I had to catch the Chinatown bus back to Philadelphia, because I had a show that afternoon. And I barely made the bus. I remember that. I barely made the bus. But I really hadn't been to New York. While I was in Ann Arbor, I got into school into Manhattan College. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, there's an excuse, or there's at least something to get me to New York. But at that point, all I really wanted was to do stand-up. Mm-hmm. But I figured the college was at least going to get me there. And so I was 30, 31 at the time, 31 when I moved here in 2014, and I'd gotten accepted, and then I, you know, enrolled at Manhattan College up in Riverdale in the Bronx, and then I signed up or whatever. I guess I paid to live on campus, because I didn't feel like looking for an apartment in New York City. So I was a 31-year-old living in a dormitory for the fall semester of 2014.
That must have been so interesting.
It was really interesting. No, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that to any poor fuck.
That'd be so
pardon my language, but
language. It's a podcast.
But I wasn't going to do that. So I paid the extra money to live alone. And to the credit of Manhattan College residence life, they saw that my sweet mate would also be a single. Mm-hmm. And he was a little older also. He was on the lacrosse team, and he had just one more semester to go. So really, he should have graduated the previous spring, but he had a few more credits to earn.
Like, he was redshirted, he had, like, an injury at some point.
Yeah, kind of thing, yeah. And he was missing, like, 3 or 6 credits, so they're like, you gotta, you know, return in the fall and just do these classes. His name was Carter, and so he was, like, 23 or 24, and... He was my sweet mate.
Mm-hmm. So it was like room, living room.
It wasn't really a living room. We had 2 different rooms. We had, you know, 2 separate doors, but we shared a bathroom that was sort of in this sort of commons doorway foyer area. But it worked out. I mean, he was a jock, but we really, we had backgammon in common. We both played backgammon.
The second time it came up, you're a backgammon aficionado.
He and I are serious backgammon aficionados.
Is backgammon a thing that you can get good at? Because isn't it a dice rolling game? So, like, at a certain point, isn't
it's a dice rolling game, but there's also strategy. And, you know, I learned a lot of the strategy from my cousin Eric, you know, during my time in Ann Arbor.
My mom and I used to play backgammon.
Yeah?
But it never was like... She used to have it, and we would play, and I would know the goals of the game. Mm-hmm. But I would always be under the understanding that, like, I gotta just roll some good fucking numbers here.
Well, at the end of the day, it is, yeah, a game of luck. But But yeah, there's a lot of predetermining what you can do with your pieces.
Mm. Yeah, I haven't thought about backgammon in so long. My mom used to have it in this like cabinet. Yeah, like range. It would be like a suitcase. Like,
yeah,
this mini suitcase.
Yeah, with the like, handle and.
My mom
yeah.
listens to this. Hi, mom. This is your second shout out.
Is it Mrs. Passeretti? Is
yeah.
It? Yeah. Hi, Mrs. Passeretti. Nice to.
Yeah, my parents
be
are
with
still
you.
Married. No, I'm kind of unique in that way that my parents have been together for a ridiculous amount of time.
Yours and mine. How long for yours?
Since high school, they went to like prom together.
So, wait, since they were in high school. Holy cow.
Yeah, and they're still
so
together.
So
my perspective on relationships is fucked.
Yo, yours, my parents met in college.
Yeah.
Yeah,
no, it's cool.
Wow.
It's an interesting, it's cool having that mm-hmm. thing. Like, it's a nice way to grow up. For
yeah.
Sure.
Isn't it funny that in this day and age, that's the conversation that we're having? Like, can you believe our
parents
are still together?
Married, right? Yeah. All my friends.
That would have been normal 50 years ago.
Yeah, now it's the anomaly, and I feel lucky to have it. And I also, in my own life, am constantly like, I would like that, but what are the odds that that happens?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, more power to them. My parents just celebrated their. Was it their 45th anniversary?
Oh, so cool.
And
I love hearing stuff like that.
Oh, I was so delighted to just ask them, you know, the advice or whatever they can tell me about. Because they didn't know at the time. They were in their early 20s.
Yeah.
And now they're in their late 60s. And, you know, to hear them say, well, it takes patience and it takes, you know, just acceptance and growing and, of course, love and... I mean, I admire a few people, if any, more than I admire my parents, just for what they've done for us and for themselves as a couple.
Oh, it's unbelievable. I give all the credit in the world to my parents. They're two of the like most amazing people I've ever... My dad works so hard. My dad doesn't have a college degree, but yet works so hard that he's like in a place where like I can live here. And
God bless him.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. It's so cool what they've done. I feel eternally grateful that I never saw them fight, really, even.
Oh. Well, that's... Now, that's an anomaly.
Like, right, they
I saw mine fight all the time.
They definitely argue. I'm not saying they had, like, a perfect thing, but they were good enough about it where they did that behind closed doors. Like,
nice.
I had a very sort of... Almost Rockwellian...
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay.
Childhood because of that. They're going to listen to this, I think, which is, it's funny because they don't usually hear me talk like that, probably, like in life, but no, I respect the crap out of both of them. They are two of the smartest people I know.
Perhaps it's easier for us, and perhaps it's human nature, for us to talk like this without them being in the room, because I don't know if I've ever expressed my appreciation for my parents and their love for one another. And the impact of just their relationship alone, and that impact on my brothers and our sister.
Mm-hmm.
But we can talk about that with them because it's not weird.
Yeah.
With them being in the room, but you know, they can listen to this.
It's super hard to like tell somebody like on like a real level. Like, there's a lot of like pullback. Like most people can't accept a compliment like that, which is fine. I mean, it's almost nicer hearing it. In a different perspective, because you know it's more honest than if you're like face to face with somebody, because you're always going to be your best self. But yeah, so New York City, when you were, how early on did you know that New York was going to be a like where you wanted it?
Immediately before I moved to Chicago, I knew that New York was the place. I think. I was familiar with everything that New York has always promised itself to be.
Like the concrete jungle where dreams are made of.
Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, the tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door.
Mildly more elegant than Alicia Keys.
Ah! But just as important, the Alicia Keys song. I mean, that's everything. Anyone who culturally has embraced New York, Stamford White, the sculpture in Greenwich Village, among his other works, and everything about this town has been everything that it, to me, had promised itself to be. And more, to the point where it's magical, and it might even get a little weird. But honest to God, this city to me has been everything.
It's so great. It's the best city in the world.
It is the greatest city in the world.
I'll defend. I mean, people are their first attack on me is always, "You don't know anything else." It's like,
no,
but it's because I started at the top.
Yeah.
New York City is the greatest. Anything that you can find in any other city, you can find in New York City is the world.
It's
the world condensed into five little towns.
Yeah.
But specifically Manhattan Island, you can find anything. Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. The best food, the craziest people. Every aspect of entertainment. I love this city.
And that's it. Every day, at least once a day, I catch myself cursing at New York City.
Oh, because it's also, at the same time, a terrible trash island full of too many people.
You know, I mean, I was on 3rd Avenue just two nights ago. I was walking up 3rd Avenue, and this is a pretty well-populated street.
Yeah.
And there was a woman... a young woman leaning up against a bank, but it was a Chase bank or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, she was squatting with her pants down.
Oh no!
And her urine was running across the sidewalk, and I had to jump over her urine. Because she was peeing, you know. Meanwhile, a garbage truck and an ambulance, and it's noisy, and for those reasons and for so many more, I hate New York City. But at the end of the day, I love everything about this town. And
it's so weird.
Every night I say goodnight to New York out loud before I get into bed. And it's maybe something superstitious or what have you. But I also feel like I owe a great deal to New York City because, as I mentioned earlier, you know, my first month in New York City was pretty hard, as it should be for anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I tweeted, about 3 or 4 weeks into my stay here in New York, while I had a dorm room, a place to sleep and running water, and still I wasn't entirely getting to where I wanted to get ultimately.
Uh-huh.
I tweeted, in quotations, "I owe you nothing." And I credited that quote to New York City.
Uh-huh.
"I owe you nothing." And it got a lot of response. And I think that's what New York City is.
It's so true. It owes you nothing. I was walking to the Climate Lounge the other day, and on 2nd and 12th, there's a movie theater called the Village East Cinemas,
mm-hmm.
which I like a lot. And Robert De Niro was out in front shooting promos for the Tribeca Film Festival, which he hosts every year. And three people were like, "Oh my God, that's Robert De Niro." And they were clearly tourists. Everybody else was just like,
"Yep, yeah,
that's a guy who's in movies, and fuck that guy for being."
He's in my way.
Yeah,
he's in my way.
He's in my way more than he's in movies.
Oh my gosh! I mean, just yesterday, it
made me so happy because, especially in the industry that we do, it's easy to get kind of caught up about ego or yourself, and then you realize that Robert De Niro, 80% of people don't give a fuck that he's standing there. But if he was to be in a mall in Florida, he'd be mobbed. It's such a cool town because it forces you immediately to be like, I am kind of out for myself.
Yeah.
And it's not in a bad way.
No.
But but you have to, nobody's going to take care of you in New York City. You have to kind of hold your ground.
Yeah. Well, eventually things sort of worked in my favor. in New York, and it all became clear, I guess, that this is exactly what New York City is. This is, it doesn't owe me anything, and yet, so far, anything and everything I could have asked for has happened. Anything and everything I could have wished for has come true. I can't believe how lucky I've been between Manhattan College and my career as a stand-up comedian, and right down to the very apartment that I've gotten. I mean, I love my apartment and I love my neighborhood. And just to consider that this apartment was available and that, you know, this worked out for me or that was able to happen. Some of it took work. A lot of it was luck. But at the end of the day, I consider how, well, this is the entire mission statement of New York City. This is the entire purpose of New York City. This was the idea of New York City and the United States. Mm-hmm. This is, I mean, there's an opportunity here.
Yeah.
And it took me 30 years, but I got to New York and everything seemed to change upon that arrival. And I'll also say that it has brought me closer to my mother. And, you know, all my life I felt as though my mother had disapproved of my either being a comedian or working in comedy, whether it was sketch or improv in Chicago. And she might be the first person to admit that she was very much opposed to my moving to New York City and perhaps even my being a comic. Mm-hmm. But when things transpired the way they did, and after things ended up the way they have ended up, and I'm doing okay, you know, I realize that it's really just been a matter of giving my mother some sort of security. And New York City is really the first place where, in my adult life, I've turned out okay. And that was, again, what I learned all my mother really wanted was just for me to be okay. Mm-hmm. And I no longer care about, you know, what kind of comedian I am for her. Because, yeah, she doesn't really have the sense of humor that I have.
Yeah.
But that doesn't matter anymore. It's just, she just wanted me to be okay.
Uh-huh.
And so since moving to New York, again, you know, with Letterman and my dad, and now with New York City giving me that all that it has given me, for my mom, it's been a great benefit, personally. Again, for my family life, but then for me personally and professionally, I'm forever in debt to New York City, and that's the fifth thing.
I think that is a perfect place to wrap up. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for bringing these things.
We ran so much longer than I would have hoped to have ran.
Hoped? No.
I hate listening to podcasts that go longer than an hour, and I think we're at 2...
We're at 2:20 right now, but it's fine. My favorite podcast is You Made It Weird, which goes 3 hours regularly. So, like, here's the thing. I never want to, like, diffuse a good conversation.
Well, that's fair.
Like, if I wouldn't want to go 2 hours where I'm constantly being like,
yeah,
let's keep this going. But yeah, we had a good conversation that lasted this long, and we could totally go longer, but I do think this is the
I think the we've logical reached that point. It's been, yeah, people want to go to bed.
Thank you for bringing these things. I'm sure people, it's my favorite part of this show is getting to know people that I like more.
And vice versa, even though I'm the one who is to talk for the most part. But we had some good conversation, didn't
we? Yeah, no, yeah. We definitely know each other a lot better than we did at the start of this, which
great.
Is the coolest thing about this show. Thank you so much for being here. Do you have anything you want to plug? Twitter, your shows?
I'm on Twitter, and I host, maybe my YouTube channel. I was at my YouTube channel today, and I think I thought, maybe I'd like to see a few more views.
What is it?
YouTube.com/Devin Keast.
There you go. YouTube.com/Devin Keast. Check it out. I am around New York City, if you know me. Follow me on Facebook for stand-up dates, Sunday nights at Lovecraft. I have been doing these Fight Club tournament things, and that's the best place to come see me right now. Thank you again, Devin, for being here.
Anthony, I love this podcast, and thanks again for having me.
All right. Till next time, guys.
Cheers.
Cheers.